Accession number 30419, reel 6.
Have anonymity in following instructions. I quite liked it. You either did it well, or you got into trouble, because if you malingered on the drill square, you were always on defaulters, which several people were, the Bolshy guys. So I thought it was better percentage not to be Bolshy on the drill square. And I also liked the fact that I could do it, because the other competition was a gymnastics competition. Forget what that was called, but it was, for me, it was absolute hell. I have absolutely no spring in my step whatsoever. I can't jump over a horse. Can't do it at all. And I tried, but I was hopeless. So I used to get bawled at and shouted at. And then there was I remember there was a swimming competition, and there was a cross-country run. There were all kinds of competitions like that. And the other, that was an athletics type of competition, and I could put the shot, but I couldn't do much else. So those kept us interested, plus the study. And by this time, we were well into the degree studies, this half a dozen of us. I think I told you about all that last time. Mm-hmm. And that kept the brain going. And I enjoyed the mathematics, because I hadn't done that at school, not nearly enough, and the electronics and the meteorology and the navigation. So the time was pretty well full. And did I tell you about the Latin last time?
I don't think so.
It was discovered that in order to matriculate for the degree, we had to have Latin. Now, I dropped out of the Latin stream after 2 years, and so there were four of us, five of us, who hadn't got Latin. So we studied Latin, and took the O-level in the summer of 1961. And there was this wonderful director of studies, Wing Commander Watts, who took us through the Latin. He was really the impetus behind the degree course, this external degree at London University, to try and raise the whole standard of academic studies at Cranwell. Not a terribly sensible idea, perhaps, but great for me, because it gave me the opportunity to get that degree, and there were others who took it on. So we would do Latin in class, and we went and did evening work at his house. And there was another guy whose house we went and did Latin studies at as well. So even the evenings, we were either doing homework or going out and studying Latin. Came the exam, and the week before the exam, Wing Commander Watts mysteriously was able to put us through specific studies for specific questions. He popped down to London and taken a look at the exam paper. Dear, oh dear. Anyway, we got through. Yes. That again was good. I was glad to do Latin, because it was something I really felt a bit ashamed about at school. I didn't manage to cling on to it, but there we are, we did Latin. Then, so all that took us through 1960, and then we went over Christmas knowing that we were going to start flying when we got back. We also moved up to the main college building from the junior entries down below the road. So we got we moved up the social ladder.
What was the main college building like?
Pretty palatial, really, compared with the South Brick Lines and the junior mess. We had rooms to ourselves. I think we'd had room for ourselves after the first term, that's right, but these were nice rooms, proper rooms with cupboards and beds and desk, and quite large. The ceilings were high because the college was built like in the 1930s, I suppose, in order to be the to rival Sandhurst and Dartmouth as being the college for the RAF. Four wings, each with a squadron in it, two stories, at least two stories, there may have been some smaller ones at the top, and long corridors going down to a lobby area with a gallery and a dome and a tower on top, and then the large ante rooms and dining room, which had a minstrel's gallery, all fairly as it should be for a military college. And on top of the tower there was a flashing light. And this flashing light we called Winking Willy because it was a strobe light with the code for the college for aircraft, so that the aircraft would know it was there. And you could see it as you came through Ancaster on the way back to college across the flat plain, a sort of a homing beacon.
You knew you were nearly back.
That's right. We used to get the odd weekend away, 36-hour pass, 1.5 days, and you go off on a Saturday if you could hitch a lift to the station or down to London and come back on the Sunday night. And you could do that a couple of times a term when we got to this stage. And a chum of mine called Bob O'Brien, who was also on the degree course, had a lovely old Riley. And I remember quite often the feeling of freedom as you left on a Saturday after a parade to go down to London for just a little time off. But when you came back, you had to get in by midnight. And we knew that if we got to a particular turning on the A1 by 11 o'clock, we could just about make it.
What happened if you didn't get in by midnight?
We used to climb in through Fazakerley's window. There was a lovely guy called Fazakerley with a such a thick Liverpool accent that the drill instructor gave him hell. It was sad, really. He was a bit gauche on the drill square as well. He was a very human sort of guy, and he also had a room with a window just by the car park, so you could scuttle across through the trees, knock on Fazak's window and he'd open it and you'd come in. But you had to then bribe the hall. It was still, I'm not quite sure how we got away with it, because you had to sign in at the hall porter's lodge. But that was one way of getting back into the college, because it was locked after midnight. So I suppose we just took we just signed in late, but at least we got in. Right, so that was Cranwell life. And then we became pilots, or trainee pilots.
Yes, so take me through that right from the beginning.
Well, the airplane was the Jet Provost, which was a new trainer. I think I said earlier this was the only reason I was there at all, because it was had a much larger side-by-side cockpit that I could fit into. It had a single jet. It was a Rolls-Royce Avon, which is extremely noisy and not terribly powerful. But it did have quite a performance. The later marks had the same sort of performance as the later Spitfires. So it was a real aeroplane, a monoplane, low-wing monoplane. Had side-by-side ejector seats. We had oxygen but no pressurization, and no pressure suits or anything like that. So we were flying these things up to 35,000 feet and putting our bodies through quite a lot of strain, because we did aerobatics pulled a lot of G, seemed like a lot of G to me, four or five. And I don't think nowadays it would be allowed, because it was in health and safety terms, a bit risky.
In what way?
Well, putting G puts your body under a lot of strain, and that can be cumulative, and certainly it was with me. I've had trouble in later life with my legs. The high rate of descent without pressurization meant that the eardrums came out of it under a lot of pressure, and again, I had a bit of trouble with the Eustachian tube, shall we say, in later life. And I'm being unpressurized at that height. Some other effects as well. I mean, some people found it was too uncomfortable and had to drop out. The flying training, we flew at Parkeston Heath, which was a satellite aerodrome. Two of the squadrons flew at Cranwell, and two others, C and D squadron, I think it was, went off to Parkeston Heath, which was about 10 miles distance on the way to Grantham. World War II aerodrome with World War II huts, and it was really quite a pleasant place. And we had a crew room which we were allowed to decorate ourselves. I remember that.
Can you just, if you just say anything to me, just so I can check your mic's working?
Yes, yes. Yes,
is it, yes, yours is fine. Working? No, we're good. Okay, and I'm going to keep a very eagle eye on what's going on.
Right. All right.
All right. So if we want to just go back and cover a clue that we may have lost. So just perhaps to, I think you got to March. You were saying you were flying more in March.
Yes.
But still not flying very often.
That's right.
And you felt a bit as if it was interrupting your academic studies.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it's an old cliche that the more you fly, the more you want to fly. And we weren't flying enough. And so it became almost a distraction to everything else that was being done. Particularly, I think, for those who were doing degrees or the AFRES qualification, the Aeronautical Society's degree equivalent examination. And there was a conflict, really, between the flying wing and the academic wing at Cranwell. And the everything else wing, the general studies, the drill, the survival, we used to have sessions with the RAF regiment about, and we used to go and fire rifles. Now, when you've gone and fired, for me anyway, a dozen rounds of a 303 rifle, I can't hear for a day. It bashes. We didn't have any ear guards. We just used to fire these rifles without any ear guards. So that was a conflict too. So it wasn't that we were trying to. I don't think it was a question of packing too much in. It's just that was what the syllabus was, and we were going to take 3 years over it. So when we started flying, there wasn't that same deadline that you've got to be done and dusted in 6 months. It was going to take right the way through to the end of the course, which from 61, 62, it was going to take a year and a half to learn to fly these machines. So it became, the flying instructors became frustrated with this as well, because they weren't getting full commitment from their students. Some of them they were, because that was all they wanted to do was fly, but then they were frustrated because they weren't flying enough. I can remember that being quite a difficulty. And then, of course, having done that, those 3 months, we then went off on vacation, didn't fly again till May the 1st. So back we came on May the 1st. I was airsick, did 1 hour with Master Pilot Good, was airsick, remembered a bit about what I was supposed to be doing, and then stopped again until May the 4th. May the 5th twice. May the 9th, big day, flew three times. So it continued to be a bit like that. The flying, but we were still flying. And when we went on vacation, we were pilots, which was great for chatting up the girls in the pub. What do you do? Oh, I'm pilot, trainee pilot, you know.
that went down well then.
Yes, and you felt good about it because you were doing this flying.
So this was part of giving you back your confidence.
Yes, I think so. I think so. Yes, that's right. It's beginning now that that the authorities have weeded out those who are obviously misfits. And now, of course, there's a weeding out on the flying, because it then comes to those who can't fly, and they get the chop, as it's called. And there's always the danger of getting the chop. You do a test every now and again, which will be with another pilot, or probably the flight commander. And I had a flight commander's check on May the 26th, which was 1 hour 20. So we would have done everything that we'd learnt thus far, and you had to show that you were coping with it. Quite a lot of people didn't. There was, again, this business about being able to judge heights. And it's the same in the jet province as the tiger moth. If you try and land 10 feet above the runway, you're in trouble. Or 10 feet under the runway, you're even more trouble. So there were two or three guys who just couldn't cope with that, and they had to leave. There were others who perhaps couldn't do instrument flying, didn't have the sufficient coordination skills to be able to fly on the instruments, and we did quite a lot of that. There were those who were unable to cope with the max rate descents. I remember the one or two medical discharges around this time. So building your confidence, yes, but also continuing to weed you out. That sounds a bit of a derogatory term, because those who were weeded out weren't weeds, they just weren't suited for the environment in the air. Everybody is.
Can we talk a bit more about the actual training? Because we obviously covered a lot of the basics when you were in Tiger Moth.
Yes.
And we touched a little bit on the differences between the Tiger Moth and the Jet Provost, but we can maybe recap those slightly just in case we lost them. But I'm just wondering about the different elements in terms of training, so what the new skills you were picking up at this stage were. So things that I don't think we talked about instrument flying particularly before, I think that's new.
No, we didn't. On the Tiger Moth, the flying scholarship, everything was visual. You had to be able to see the horizon. You didn't fly unless it was visual. Mm. With the Jet Provost, quite early on, you started learning to fly on the instruments. Going up to those heights, you'd almost of necessity be going through clouds. And I can see that I did 10 minutes of instrument flying on my seventh trip in the Jet Provost, for example, and I'd done 40 minutes in clouds by the end of February that year. There was one spectacular occasion. I think it must have been it was fairly early on when we all went off on solo flights, and there was cloud, a fairly low ceiling, but the meteorological officer said that it was clearing at 10,000 feet, so you'd be going through 10,000 feet or 9,000 feet of cloud, and then you pop out on top. And this was an excellent opportunity for us to practice our instrument approaches, which we used to do. We used to fly on a beam and come down under instruments, under control from the electronics on the airfield. Well, this cloud actually went up to 30,000 feet. And I was fortunate. I hadn't gone very far, and I came back down. That we were all recalled. But some of my young colleagues, fairly green in the whole affair, had to fly for about an hour on instruments, actual. That was quite an occasion. So the instrument flying was, I found it fascinating, because being able to control just from what you can see on the instrument panel, that's got the same attraction as a computer game, shall we say.
Well, tell me what it's like. So you're sitting in the cockpit, because it's very hard to imagine. You're in the cockpit, fog all around. What are you looking at? What are your instrument panels that you're looking at and thinking about?
You've got a blind flying panel, which is in the middle, which has an airspeed indicator, an altimeter, turn and slip indicator, and rate of climb and descent. I think those are the main instruments. So you keep straight by, or a compass, of course, a compass, or a direction. I think we had a horizontal type compass which rotated, so you could always see the magnetic heading that you were on. So you kept straight with that, and with the artificial horizon, because if your wings were level, you were probably going straight. If your turn and slip was showing that you got the rudder in the right place, for going up and down, you use the rate of climb and descent indicator. And of course, the airspeed. You've got to keep a beady eye on your airspeed, because you can't rely on one instrument. You've got to make a summation of all of them. If you keep your airspeed at 120 knots, for example, you could be going down or up, depending upon what your power setting is. So you've got to look at all the instruments together and keep scanning the instruments. You develop a technique of scanning the instrument. Then, of course, if you have to turn, you have to use the artificial horizon to get the bank that you want, and you use the turn and slip to make sure you're balancing the turn with the rudder, and the altimeter to make sure that you're maintaining height, and the power to make sure you're maintaining the speed. So you're working them all together as you make a turn. If it's a steep turn on instruments, you've got to remember that as you get a certain amount of bank on, the rudder becomes the elevator, so you start to control your height with the rudder rather than with the elevators, stick backwards and forwards. And balance the turn and get a bit of power on to keep the nose up to make sure you're not losing height. And then if you need to descend, then if you're doing it straight, you, of course, ease the power off and let the speed come back, and then you'll automatically go down. And you'll know how fast you're going down by the rate of climb and descent indicator. And then you level off, you power attitude trim, that's it, power on, then you change your attitude, then you trim the aeroplane and level it out and make sure your speed's right. Then if you want to go up, it's the reverse, power on, attitude, and then, well, it's not the reverse, you put your power on first, of course, and then you just do it going upwards. I don't think there's much else to say about instrument flying, actually, that I can explain anymore, except that you can get disorientated, and if you're disorientated, you hope to heck that there's another pilot with you. I don't think I suffered too much in the Jet Provost, but later on I have been disorientated in flying the Argosy and just had to hand over control, because you don't know where you are. It's called the leans, and you can't rely on your sense of direction and positioning when you can't see out. I should say that there's two ways of doing instrument flying. One is for real, when you're in cloud, and the other is simulated, and they put a hood on your helmet. So for a test, you put a hood on the helmet, so all you can see is the instrument. You can't see out. You're flying under the hood. And you have to rely on your instruments, because your body tells you all sorts of different things. Those tubes in your ears get scrambled. The seat of the pants is the lousiest way to fly, because the seat of your pants tells you different things depending upon what the air currents are doing. And you can lose your sense of direction very, very easily. So you just have to believe what the instruments are telling you.
So the leans is when you kind of lose your sense of what the instruments are telling you, and you're scrambled at the same time.
That's right. The leans is you get your body gets scrambled. You have to therefore concentrate on the instruments and work your way through it. Because if you're solo, you haven't got anybody to hand over to. You've just got to. So that guy who was flying for an hour in the clouds, after flying for about 4 months, he was a fast learning curve.
So, what other things were new in terms of the learning process?
Well, what else was new? The emergency procedures, of course. There weren't any in the Tiger Moth, because you had no parachutes. You just force landed. But in the Jet Provost, you had to. You had the ejector seats, and I never ever used them. I don't think they were ever used on my course.
How did they teach you how to eject?
You had a test run on a Martin Baker simulator thing, which was a long ramp, vertical ramp, on which ran an ejection seat. So you sat on this ejection seat, pulled the blind over your face, and up you went, bosh. You had to keep your back straight, otherwise you would get compression difficulties. So it was that's what happened. The ejector seat worked. You had to make sure the pins were out. It was part of the pre-flight checks, because there were safety pins put in, and so if those weren't taken out, when you pulled the handle to eject, nothing would happen. You had a handle above your helmet, which you grabbed hold on with both hands behind your head and pulled the blind down over your face. Or you had another handle between your legs, which you could pull up, because you needed, it depends on what happened to the aeroplane, but if you were in a steep spinning descent, you may not be able to get your hands up to the one up here. The G forces could be pushing your hands down, so you could pull the lower blind. The canopy would then eject of its own accord, if I remember rightly. So the canopy would fly off, that's the idea, and out you go, hoping that your knees didn't catch the cockpit combing in front of you. You then sit in the ejector seat, and everything happens automatically. There's a little drogue parachute comes out, and that then pulls out the main parachute. And I'm not sure whether the seat then falls away or whether you have to do something about that. But the idea is that you land free of the seat. And never had to do it for real, but we had a practice on this Martin Baker simulator.